I'm Tim Ventura from AmericanAntiGravity.com, and I'm speaking today with Marcus Hollingshead from Great Britain, an anti-gravity inventor who stunned the world in 2003 with announcements about a new type of anti-gravity device that creates hundreds of pounds of thrust. Marcus, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, fine, Tim. No problem.
Great. Well, you know, at first I should say thanks. I know you've been a bit difficult to get in touch with, and part of that's probably from the publicity that you've had. It's been difficult probably to, get around, I guess, the unwanted phone calls at all hours of the day for at least a while that were occurring.
Yeah, from my point of view, I think there was a time when I needed to get focused on what I was doing, and it wasn't spending time on the internet or spending time on the phone, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. Well, no one's really heard an update on your research in the last year, and
sure.
From what you'd indicated earlier, I know there's a lot that you can't tell us because it's proprietary information, but is there anything that you'd be willing to share with the public?
In effect, we've moved on quite a lot from the early devices, which I think you've probably got information on the website. We're pretty much into solid-state devices. We have really been spending the last year, maybe a bit longer, trying to understand the changes in the properties of the RP, which, if you remember, is the centrally charged device at the core of my device. That has pretty much taken us down some very interesting routes in the physics direction. And as the changes in properties of the RP really have defined the usefulness of the device and the number of hours of operation that we can take it to, really that's been at the core of the research up to date.
Oh, okay. Now, in terms of thrust, you had mentioned when I first started talking to you, you were mentioning small amounts, I think it was 20 or 30 pounds. And then, as we talked more, and as time went on, you were able to actually goose that up a fair amount to.
The 20 to 30 pounds was really the weight of the yoke base that my very first version was attached to. So the first sort of indications of reliable thrust were really the device's ability to lift itself, and the frame and the base in which it was attached. Since I think versions which would be 160, 161, they've been in the tons. I mean, we've been working in tons now for a long time.
Oh, so you're lifting actually tons of weight then?
Yeah, most of the solid state devices that we're working with are probably somewhere in the region of 6,000 to 7,000 kilograms of lift.
Oh, that's incredible. You must have to bolt those down with chains to keep them from taking the floor with them.
Yeah. There isn't really a requirement to bolt them down with chains. I mean, they are controllable. So, we're not worried about them disappearing through the ceiling.
Oh, okay.
They're basically attached to string devices, so we can measure what it is that they're doing, and we can keep them under control. Most of the work over the last year, as I said, has really been putting them under continuous strain so that we can then take the RP off and do some work on it and find out what's happened to it.
Yeah, now
we'll attach these things to a variety of gauges, worked out what it is that they're pulling, worked out the work which is going through the RP, and then taking the RP off and sliced it up.
Oh, okay. And is it still essentially an iron core that magnetic?
It's still essentially an iron core. There's some fairly exotic variations on it now, and there's some pretty good reasons for some of the changes. I must admit, it would be wrong for people to assume that I'm a hardcore physicist. Some of the changes that have been made, I don't understand myself, but they have a lot to do with the changes in the property of the nucleus of the iron in the RP.
Oh, okay. And those are made by some of your colleagues then, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay, you'd mentioned in the past that you were working with at least a few other people.
Yeah. There's now a group of us, yeah.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. Well, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask what your commercial time frame is for these.
I mean, going back a year or two now, I think I was naively optimistic in terms of what could be done sooner rather than later. But in terms of developing a reliable commercial piece of equipment that you can sell, the fundamental problems that we've dealt with is to do with the RP. The RP's lifespan, the number of hours that it can operate continuously, are very variable, and the variances are down to the core structure of the RP, how it is actually put under strain. Finding a way of describing this. In effect, if you and your listeners can understand, if you think about the nucleus of any atom, you've got neutrons and protons, and a neutron is a slightly heavier version of a proton, and some people think of the neutron as being a proton with an electron added plus a bit of energy.
Sure.
Effectively, all the work which has been done by people like Searle or anybody else has been working in the magnetism stroke heavy electricity format for trying to find a way of creating a gravitational thrust or anti-gravity has basically been, where successful has been to make an alteration in the proportion of neutron to proton inside the core, inside the nucleus of the individual atoms of the iron core. And the problem is that the more energy you put through that, in effect what you're doing is you're changing the balance of neutrons to protons in the core, and at a certain point, depending on how much energy you're pushing through this thing, you could actually make a fundamental change in terms of what it is that atom now is. It's no longer iron, if you like. That's at the point where the RP starts to break down seriously and we start to have some serious problems. But fundamentally, that's where the commercial hiccup is.
Oh, okay. They simply can't run forever, and you can't
Oh no,
really.
we can run some at the moment on relatively light loads for a couple of thousand hours. And if you think of early aircraft engines, that's pretty comparable. You know, it's actually getting that sort of like 2,000 hours reliable. It's like we are dealing with an early engine. We've got some which we think are identical to ones which have run for 1,000 hours or 2,000 hours, now run for 10. Now the understanding of what it is, and usually it's down to something like the purity of the material that we're working with. If the material isn't cast correctly, if there's any change, if there is an irregularity inside the crystalline structure of the metals that we're using, then we'll see some serious failures.
Oh, okay. Well, back to neutrons for a second. When you mentioned that the gravity effect affects those, and you'd said that this was also a topic you'd wanted to focus on a bit in the email you sent me yesterday. Now, is it that there's just a spin on them? Is it more of a just the way that they're manipulated?
The sort of understanding that I feel that I've got over the last couple of years about gravity is actually a lot simpler than we all think. If we do some sort of 101 on this, I mean, basically gravity is something that we experience because we're wandering around on top of a huge ball of matter,
Oh, sure.
which we call the Earth. And basically, all atoms produce a number of fields. The ones that we sort of like see, which are obvious ones, are things like electrical fields, obviously. But you know, we understand those. We've been manipulating for a long time. We were basically playing around with the electrons in that case. We've got magnetic fields, which we also have some understanding of. But what we're dealing with when we're dealing with anti-gravity is really a whole group of fields which are incredibly weak in themselves when we look at just individual atoms. But when you put enough of them together, for instance, in a planetoid scale, then you know we have a very discernible effect. And what if you like, by mistake, when I first started working playing around with it, I started building up what I thought was a model of the way the Earth had an iron core, had magnetic fields moving around it, and really, you know, my original designs were more of a sort of accidental way of getting to where I got to, in the same way maybe that, it was like here's a model which I want to create, and the model I think will provide something. I don't know what it would be, but it's actually more of an accident that I got where I got to, rather than a designed process. I've done quite a lot of reading on what Searle had been doing, and what the disc company and people like that are doing, and in fact it's incredibly similar. In effect, what you're doing is you are forcing the atoms, which are, if you like, the focus of an intense magnetic or electromagnetic effect, to basically change the properties which they normally would exhibit. And when you start to push some protons into becoming neutrons, is when you start to see some of the field effects. That's in all the work that we've done, this seems to be the way in which the gravitational effects are being created. The things which you know, if you look at what Searle did, if you look at my design, which isn't really that far away from where Searle was, in effect, we're using a relatively high voltage, I suppose. We're using a magnetic field, and we're using some degree of movement, and we're actually forcing a focal point of these things onto something. In my case, it was an RP. In Searle's case, it's a little bit less obvious exactly what's going on. But by focusing that effect on the RP, in effect, what I was doing is forcing some of the electrons which were being pumped into the RP, because don't forget it was a charged device, to basically be pushed into the nucleus of the atom. So rather than being, you know, your sort of classic chemistry field of electrons around the nucleus, you know, you're starting to push these things closer and closer and closer. So eventually what happens is you actually marry up an electron with a proton. You then have a situation where you have a proton moving into a neutron state, not quite, but near enough. And there's quite a lot of energy released with that. And there's quite a lot of, if you can keep that at that balance, basically it just starts to pull energy into itself. And then one of the side effects of that energy, because the energy has to go somewhere, turn into something, is basically a boost in the field effects, which we think of as gravity.
Oh, okay. That is pretty in-depth, and I realize you're simplifying that down for both my
Yeah, I mean, if I started to talk about quarks and things in no time at all, I'd be lost, because I really don't understand it when it gets down to that level. I'm not a physicist, and I'm not... I've had it explained to me in layman's terms of what the idea is. The reason that we're fairly certain that there's something going on where there's a change in the nucleus is that when we actually start to look at what it is that we've got left in the RP after we've used it for a period of time, we very definitely don't have the same material that we started with.
So it's no longer iron; it's actually turning into.
Well, if you think of it, it's more like an isotope line. You ended up with something which has got more neutrons than it should do.
Oh, I see what you mean. So
okay. Now the decay effect of that basically means is that we start to make the thing unstable.
Yeah. Well, now you'd mentioned a while ago that you'd wanted to measure some of these for nucleotides. You know, some nuclear byproducts from these transmutations. Were you ever able to pick anything up like that?
There's been quite a lot of work done on that, and that's not really something that. I don't really think I should talk about it. It's one of the things that we've been working on.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I won't go into that area then.
If this can become a commercial device, the really that sort of information is what will give us a head start on anyone else. It's our ability to produce an RP which is reliable in terms of the number of hours that it will operate and the amount of thrust that it will put. It will allow it to be put through it. It's sort of pretty critical, I suppose, commercially.
Oh, okay. Oh, in terms of control for the device, as I recall, your early devices had six coils, and by powering up pairs of two, you were able to give it directional control for all three axes.
In effect, all coils were moving at the same speed. The change in the charge that you put down any one coil, if you think of them X, Y, Z axis, whether you're talking about positive Z, negative Z, positive Y, negative Y, positive X, negative X, if you wanted it to go in a certain direction, you basically changed the balance. Once you got to there was like a threshold point where you basically got the whole thing in balance. And after that, once you started to raise the power on any one of those six coils, then you started to affect a movement in that direction.
Oh, okay. So by basically providing power, to a different
Yeah,
set.
effectively, yeah, absolutely,
Now, has
absolutely. Now the power you put in is not initially is sort of equal to the amount of power that you see the force see the device exerting. But then you start to get on to the device exerting a huge amount more power than you're actually putting into it. And this is really where we go back down to the chemistry, sorry, the physics of what's going on inside the nucleus of the atoms which form the RP.
Oh,
Because
sure.
that's effectively, we're sort of producing maybe one of the terms I've heard bandied around in the lab is an energy lens. We're basically pulling electrons into the core and then producing a huge amount of energy in one form or another. We think of it as a gravity field out the other side.
Oh, speaking of lenses, I had forgotten to ask, and I really should do this for the audience's sake. What are the effects that you described before? Because in addition to gravity, there are a number of other effects. As I recall, at one time, your prototypes were running cold and creating a force field.
The coldness is fairly easily explained. We start literally pulling energy from the Earth surrounding environment. So that if you think of it as an electron pump, you're basically sucking any free electrons from around. You in effect are supercooling what's around it. In fact, there's a very interesting byproduct to this. If we start to think of superconductivity, I think when you look at what happens when you supercool a material in order to produce a superconductor, in effect you're sort of like dampening down the process of these sort of like physical agitation within the individual atoms and the lattice in which they exist.
Oh,
Now,
definitely.
effectively by pulling electrons into the nucleus of a device, you're actually pretty much doing something very similar. You're sort of compressing the nucleus of the atoms that you've got. You're also changing their physical structure, what they're made up of. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in the future that if you start to look at things like black holes, superconductivity, and all of these things which we sort of want to get to know about, we want to start to try and commercialize an understanding of them. For instance, superconductors, obviously there's an awful lot of reasons why we want those things. But if you start to change, if we start to become able to alter the basic balance of the nucleus, or for instance, in this case, iron, then we can start to see some of these effects as byproducts and therefore, useful byproducts indeed.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you'd mentioned a shielding effect also, like kind of a bubble of dark, almost fog, if I recall.
That's pretty much a similar sort of thing. In effect, when we get to the point where we keep the thing in balance. In other words, we're not pushing out any field. We're not making it do anything. We're just letting it sit there and just sort of like produce more and putting more and more energy into it. In effect, what's happening is it basically is pulling in. We're seeing a sort of like a fogging around it. And it is very definitely something to do with a field effect around the RP, providing a sort of whether you want to call it an energy lens, call it what you will, it has an effect on light. It has an effect on in fact, any EM that we have, electromagnetic radiation around it. So that will only really happen, though, if you have the thing in balance and you're just pushing more and more power into it.
Sure.
It's not something which is a feature of a device doing useful work.
Yeah, you'd mentioned that in the past, that if you turn all of the coils on, it just sits there. But you'd also mentioned this field, this black fog, I guess there's a perimeter around it, and you'd actually tried hitting
it
with a hammer.
You can. That's slightly different. I mean, basically, if you're creating a shield effect, if you're producing a field effect at a defined distance, in other words, you're not focusing it to a point, you're starting to create an all englobing field, then fine. You've got something physically that you can touch. It's like a hard invisible skin. It is a field effect.
Oh wow, yeah. Wow. Yeah. So this is going to be a multi-function device then once it hits the market.
Well, the thing is, when we think of anti-gravity, we basically think of something like a thruster. We think of something where we can basically put energy at one end and push something out the other end, and you know, we're sort of thinking like jets and rockets. That's the way we think of being able to move around. Now, the thing about a field, if you think of a magnetic field, is that a magnetic field in itself doesn't necessarily want to behave in that way. And it's the same with the fields which are produced by the RP. In effect, the RP will produce a field which will be uniform in all directions. And we then force the RP to produce a field which has got a direction to it, a vector to it.
Oh, okay. Well, in terms of commercial publicity, I guess, or you know, just telling the public more about it. You'd mentioned in the past that you'd planned to unveil this sooner or later, and I know
yeah.
the deadline has been
yeah.
getting pushed back, but. Any thoughts on when you're going to go public with it?
I think and it's not entirely my decision anymore. I think the current thinking behind that is to produce a reliable, almost commercially viable device prior to going any further. That effectively means that we need to crack the problem with the RP. We're pretty sure that it's achievable in a relatively short time frame. But when I say short time frame, within a couple of years, maximum, the last figures I saw were sort of like 9 to 12 months on the optimistic side. But in terms of starting to commercialize it, in terms of putting it out there for anyone to be able to purchase, then there are quite a lot of factors, social and otherwise, that we have been made aware of that we should take into account when we start to move down that path.
Oh, yeah.
And it won't be just our decision when we do this.
Oh, okay. Now, are you kind of hinting at kind of government involvement then, or just business
backing? Oh, yeah. You could say that.
Oh, okay. Well, and I won't push too far in that area either, although it seems like the kind of technology that's so remarkable that, you know, I wouldn't be able to go very far without.
It's remarkable, and it's very, very useful, but it also has some pretty... we live in the Western world. We're sort of used to the things which happen around us. You know, we look out the window and we'll see, you know, thousands of cars go by. We'll see electricity cables going through the air. We'll see a bunch of things. Now, you know, I leave it to everyone's imagination to imagine if you didn't need those things in the same way. If we didn't need oil in the same way, you know, there are a lot of considerations. I mean, we have a whole Western infrastructure based around these things, and you can't go in and just start knocking it down. You know, you've got to do this brick by brick.
Oh,
you know, if you start to go out there, you've got to go out in a brick by brick format, and how you're allowed to do that is really the game of politics.
That makes sense. In other words, it's a technology that's so disruptive, even in a good way disruptive, that it's the kind of thing that has to be integrated slowly. And
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that we started discussing, and this will be a year and a half ago, were being able to produce devices which could be, if you like, load lighteners for commercial aircraft. And it was as simple as that. That's the things we wanted to start off with. Now, even that has huge implications, not just in terms of safety, but in terms of designing aircraft. I mean, if you're going to put something like this into an aircraft, then you have to think about the way in which an aircraft is normally balanced, how it's normally balanced for flight. You can't just suddenly put something in which is going to make a change the way an aircraft weighs, the weight of an aircraft. It isn't as easy to go out there and just suddenly produce a small-scale application for these things to start to integrate them slowly into. Because, as soon as they're out there, people can start to reproduce them, people can start to really look at them, people can start to, it doesn't take people long to start to tinker with things and try and make them do things that they otherwise weren't designed for. You live in a society which is, and same as we do actually now, is full of legal and fraught with legal problems. If you start producing something and it fails, if you start to produce something and it is commercially destroying something else, you have to be prepared for that. You can't. It's easy to say just do it, but then it's not quite so easy when you start to think of the implications of doing it.
Sure. One of the ideas that I've had in the past, and I think other people have also kind of looked at this route, was going with GM. And, or at least here in the States, they seem to have a lot of electric car programs going on, and they're looking at some of these innovative technologies, but they're also looking at integrating those into small-scale transportation. So it would be disruptive, but maybe not
You
that
know, you,
harmful.
one of the things that we have to do still quite a lot of work on is basically biological effects, which may be a long-term consequence of being close to the fields which you're producing. Now, we aren't aware of any, but we also, if you think of how close you are sitting to an engine when you're in a car, I mean, okay, you're sitting on top of, a few tens of pounds of explosive petrol, but if you're thinking in terms of having a device which is working in a field effect, I mean, we are already, as users of mobile phones, absolutely aware of what, a lot of people go around saying, oh God, I'm feeling unwell, I've been near these, electric fields, field. There are things that we still need to do. And in terms of being able to go out with an absolutely safe first product, the floor is open to debate.
Oh,
It won't be
certainly.
as a propulsion device for a car, I can tell you that much.
Sure. Well, we're just about at the half hour mark. I was wondering, I'm just about out of questions for today, but I guess first of all, I should ask if you'd be open to another interview at some point in the future.
Oh,
And
sure. I mean, we're starting to, I mean, we're starting to pull ourselves out of sort of like enforced hermitage. And I think, I mean, pretty much, if you think about me as an individual, I mean, what I can put into what's going on at the moment is absolutely minimal. I mean, I can come up with ideas, but in terms of actually understanding the physics and understanding what the hell's going on, I'm a complete layman. I'm just I'm on the periphery of a lot of the stuff. We really are. I mean, if you like, I could almost consider myself to be a catalyst, but I'm nothing more than that now. But I'm more than willing to, have another interview sometime in the future. If you've got questions you want to come up with, I can try and get some more information in regards if people are interested in exactly what we think is going on in terms of the nucleus of the atoms that are in the RP, because I think, you know, fundamentally, if we look at what's going on in terms of producing a usable or any usable fields, you know, the place we start looking is the nucleus of the atom, and that's where they're coming from. That's what we're actually producing. I mean, all we're doing is we're focusing the fields which are naturally there. We're not capable of looking at how small these things actually are on an atom by atom scale. It's only when you get a planetary sized body that we actually are starting to, you know, you get a gravity effect that we really can see and play with and understand. But what we're trying to do, if you like, is we're trying to find a way of focusing enough power into what produces those fields in the first place to provide us with something useful.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, you know, before we close, is there anything just in general off-the-cuff thoughts that you might have that you'd be interested in sharing? Or?
Yeah, I think we should take our hats off to Searle. I think he was the first one to really start to push the envelope with regards to electromagnetic effects on the nucleus. I mean, one of the things I will say is that the problem with what I've looked at with his stuff is there isn't a focus for what he's done. You know, within his equipment, within his experiments, there wasn't necessarily a point at which these forces were focused and therefore provided a reliable return. However, I do think he was the first one to really understand the electromagnetic requirement to provide us with work, you know, where we're going with anti-gravity or gravity. Think of it more. I think anti-gravity is the wrong way. We're not talking about anti-gravity. Anti-gravity imagine, if you will, what we're doing is we're just shining a very, very bright light, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to focus that bright light in order to provide us with a very intense beam, which we can then, you know, if you put a bright light in front of the sun, you know, you won't see it. But if you can provide a very intense beam of light, then you can probably see that. Effectively, what we're doing, we're trying to focus the field effects in such a way that we can use them usefully. And I do think that, you know, when we look back at this in 10, 15 years' time, it really will be what Searle did originally, which will have been a kickoff point for a lot of this stuff.
Well, a lot of these things do end up kind of coming back and tying into the Searle effect, which is kind of a strange coincidence, but, you know, it's been around for a long time, and so...
Yeah, well, you see, when I started off, I didn't even know about Searle. I mean, you know, what Searle had done was complete news to me, but I don't believe that it was necessarily an accident that he produced what he produced. Necessarily, it wasn't, I mean, more of an accident for me than it was for him.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
To some degree.
Well, but you see, whereas his, I think his device is being almost two-dimensional. The difference between his device and my device was really the RP, and mine was more three-dimensional.
In terms
of the field effects.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying.
And I think that was the major change which allowed me to see far more reliable effects than he was able to see with his devices.
Sure. No, that makes sense. Well, thanks again for your time today, and I
no
look
worries,
forward...
No worries, Tim. It's nice to speak to you. Long time no speak.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's been great to touch base with you, and it's also wonderful to be able to finally put some of this information out there and let people who are, you know, interested in this learn a little bit more about your work and a little bit more about you as a person. So,
well, you know, if anybody is going into physics 101 at college now, they should really get into core nuclear physics, because I think there's going to be a lot of work going along in that particular line in the next 10 years, 20 years.
Definitely.
We're just starting with it, but I think that's going to be the core direction for a lot of people to look at.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for your time, Marcus.
No worries.
And definitely
okay,
we look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye.
Cheers. Bye.